good evening and welcome. It's wonderful to see you all here. Thank you for joining us at what is the third event in the Writers' Centre Norwich's National Conversation. My name is Ella Allfrey, and I'm a board member of the Writers' Centre Norwich and also the general editor of the Conversation series. It's my great pleasure to welcome you this evening to our event, Living Translation, with Ali Smith, Margaret Jill Costa, Xiaolu Go, and the chair, Daniel Hahn. Before I hand over to Daniel, I'd like to say a few words about the National Conversation and why we're hosting this series of 14 events across the country and indeed beyond over the next 2 years. Writers' Centre Norwich works with writers, literary translators, readers, publishers, agents, booksellers, and many others in the literary ecology. Along with all these colleagues, and many of you in the audience here this evening, we've been witness to the changes taking place in our industry over recent years. Decent technologies, digital technologies even. Digital technologies transforming publishing opportunities and the retail book trade facing serious challenges. The struggle to fund libraries and the rise of the creative writing program are just a few of the many tectonic shifts affecting us all. In 2010, Norwich became England's first UNESCO City of Literature, joining Edinburgh, Melbourne, Dublin, Iowa City, Reykjavik, and Krakow. This week, Heidelberg, Prague, Granada, and Dunedin have joined the exclusive club. At the heart of Norwich's ambition to be a UNESCO City of Literature was a plan to create a real and a virtual space, a national centre for writing, where we could discuss literature, creative writing, reading, and literary translation, where people can come together and try new things, form new partnerships, and dream up new ventures. Our campaign to build a physical centre is ongoing, and we're excited about the plans to open the doors in the autumn of 2016. But without excellent partners and great ideas for the project, this centre will not be an active or vibrant place. So to this end, we've created a series of debates and commissions with partners across the country to explore the key issues facing all those who love books and love reading. We started in Edinburgh at the Book Festival this summer with Michael Rosen, who we commissioned to ask, what is the point of books? Our next event was the Cheltenham Literature Festival with Will Self, Maureen Freely, and Dan Franklin, with Will giving us his unique take on reading, writing, and losing our minds. Tonight, we're delighted to welcome you to the third of our events. Ali Smith, a patron of the National Centre for Writing and a former board member, has accepted a commission to look at the importance of translation for our literary culture. She'll present her commission first, and then will be joined in conversation by Margaret Jill Costa and Xiaolu Go, moderated by the author, translator, and chair of the Society of Authors, Daniel Hahn. The commissions and events from this national conversation are a starting point, not a destination. These conversations are already producing further debates, collaborations, developing projects, and plans for work at the new National Centre for Writing. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about this evening's debate on social media, via email, and even by letter. If you have information in your hand, you have information in your hands provided to you on the way in, and we'd very much like to hear from you. That's all from me, and I'll hand you over to Daniel Hahn. Daniel.
Thank you, Ella. Good evening. Some of you may have seen online today there was an announcement of a survey. Apparently the most badly behaved girl's name I read. This is Ella, apparently. So we have to keep an eye out for that one. We have a troublemaker with us. As Ella said, my name is Daniel Hahn, and I'm a translator, and I'm delighted to have been asked to chair this conversation about a big and complicated and fascinating subject with these three wonderful people. Where exactly this conversation is going to go, I'm not entirely sure, which is sort of the point. We're going to wait and see what Ali has to say to us. She is meant to be giving us a provocation. I think we are fairly easily provoked as a group. We will see how we respond. But we're going to leave lots of time at the end for you to ask questions and to join the conversation. I think it's important that it isn't just us telling you things that we think that many of you have possibly heard us say already several times. So we're going to have lots of time for you to join us. I'm just going to introduce our three speakers very briefly, and then we'll ask Ali to do the actual hard work of this evening. Briefly then, just to my immediate right, this is Xiaolu Guo, who's an author and a filmmaker. Her novels include Village of Stone, which was shortlisted for the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, a concise Chinese-English dictionary for lovers, which was shortlisted for the Orange Prize, and most recently, I Am China. And I wanted to mention those first two particularly because what is remarkable about them is these are two books which are shortlisted for major prizes in two different languages. One is a book written in Chinese and translated into English, shortlisted for the Indie, and one was a book written in English and shortlisted for the Orange Prize. There are not many writers, by which I mean I think there is one writer who has that sort of distinction. Though we discovered just now in the green room, actually, that she's just embarking on a translation. So she is, as well as being much translated herself, she is going to start translating, which has been translated into 26 languages, I'm told, which is not unimpressive. So we're going to talk, I think, about the process of writing and the process of being being a translatee, if that is a word. It'll do for now. To Xiaolu's right is a translator, Margaret Jewel Costa, who is one of our great translators from Portuguese and Spanish, who's translated contemporary writers and classics. She's the translator of José Saramago, the Portuguese Nobel laureate, Javier Marias, Essa de Queiroz, commercial writers like Paulo Coelho, fantastic literary novelists like Bernardo Arteaga, an amazing range. She's won the Impact Prize, she's won the Weidenfeld, the Oxford Weidenfeld Prize 3 times, the Valle Inclán Prize 3 times, etc., etc., etc. You get the general idea. I'll also just mention briefly that she was recently elected Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and, like, 2 weeks ago, I think, got her OBE. And the reason I mention this is because these are very unusual for translators. Any kind of big public recognition for a translator is very unusual. Yeah. So Margaret is, we knew that she was special anyway, but it's lovely that other people have noticed apart from just, you know, us and our friends in this room. At the far end, of course, is Ali Smith, who is fantastic novelist, who is an ambitious writer and a playful writer and a generous writer. Her most recent novel, How to Be Both, was reviewed yesterday in the LA Review of Books, which said, having now read it twice, I've decided, and I do not write this flippantly, that Ali Smith is a genius. So, which is not...
Read it again.
It's not bad. We'll project it up there, and you can just bask in that. It's nice, isn't it? Ali is critically loved. She's loved by critics, by readers. She's loved by translators, which is not always the case with writers. I wrote something on Facebook today saying Ali Smith doing a talk about translation at the South Bank, and a rather distinguished translator wrote the following: Ali Smith is the only British author who should be allowed to talk about translation. No. Scratch that, he said. Ali Smith is the only British author who should be allowed to talk. It's just as well you're who we've got, actually, isn't it? Ali is a terrific novelist. She is a fantastic reader. I think this is important, a reader with very wide horizons. And as you will discover very shortly, she is also quite a good talker. Ali, talk for us.
I'm going to ask the nice man in the lighting box, I think it's a man, it could be a lady, a nice lady in the lighting box or a man, to turn the lights up on the audience a bit. This isn't just to make sure you're not all asleep, it's actually because it feels nicer if we can all see each other. Otherwise, I've got a light kind of shining at me and you know, you tend to feel a bit stranded. Thank you. Hello. Literary translation, a provocation. Being provocative about the act of translation is a bit like being provocative about the act of breathing. So the first thing I'm going to say tonight is breathing is really important, and if we don't do it, we run out of oxygen and we die. And the next thing I'm going to say is that, like breathing, we are translating things without even knowing we're doing it or thinking about it all the time. It's a fundamental human act. The subtleties of breathing affect posture, heart rate, body energy, blood pressure. Breath is one of the sources of any physical voice. Breath, a word from the 1300s, from the Old English via the Old High German, Bradam, steam, breath. Literary, a 1640s word from the French littéraire, from the Latin literarius, meaning belonging to learning or letters. It's an adjective. It means concerning the writing, study, or content of literature, especially of the kind valued for quality of form. Is there such a thing as literary breathing? Yes. Literary breathing, you might say, is what happens when we start to think of breath as both material and conceptual, say, when we call it life force. Literary breathing is what happens when God or a goddess breathes into clay in all the creation stories and the result is the first human. It's why inspiration is called inspiration, breath, and why at the end of life we expire, we run out of steam. Translate. From the early 1300s, to remove from one place to another, also to turn from one language to another. It's from the old French translate and Latin translatus, carried over, the past participle of transferi, to bring over, carry across. Literary translation, a carrying across which belongs to learning or letters, concerned with the writing, study, and content of literature, especially of the kind valued for quality of form. Here's my first provocation about literary translation, and it's one that comes as naturally as breathing to any reader or writer or lover and valuer of the book as form. Literary translators are not paid enough. Literary translators should be paid more. Literary translators are paid far too little relative to the amount of work and the level of expertise that translating, and especially literary translating, takes. Literary translators, now this is radical, should be paid a proper royalty. Literary translators' names should be as prominent on the fronts of the books they've translated as that of the original writer, and ought, too, to be dealt with equally in the media and in the critical coverage of the books that they've translated. The ways in which we undervalue the literary translator in our UK publishing and media industries is indicative of, and connected to, the ways in which we have undervalued literary translation itself in those industries. I know that the translator is first and foremost a writer. Anyone who's heard me talk about this before will know that I can go on about this for hours, that I think translators are just as much writers as the original writers they translate, if not more so. I have a theory that translators have to be more writer than the original writer. It's something about the generosity with which they must treat the work, something about the ingenuity it takes, the true and double-layered level of creativity, the book as it is, and the book made new and right in its new language, coupled with a profoundly critical understanding of the books in their hands. It's a twin responsibility, one that takes in the original language and form and finds the new language and the shape into which the book is to be redelivered. It's about expertise and inventiveness, with the gulf between the languages, as well as the meeting points and the shared grounds between the languages. It's about both these languages' traditions and both those languages' literary traditions too. It's about an understanding of the book you're translating both in the world and in the context of all the other books by its writer and by all the other writers which produced it. It's about an embodying both of the book's intentions and its original writer's intentions, which probably means knowing the original writer's work, I mean the whole body of that work, even the as yet unwritten work, inside out. Two things here. I remember talking to Gillian Beer, who's a great critical thinker, about one of the Wolfe books that she'd been writing about. She's not a translator, but she's, as I say, she's a kind of critic in translation all the time. And she told me that a close reading, line by line, of Wolfe had actually let her see what Wolfe was not writing, had chosen to leave out of the sentence. It's attention on that level that literary translators must apply to a work. And another thing, I've had translators, who translate me, and I've even gone up to Inverness where I lived as a child and wandered about there, just especially to embody the hometown, the very geographical route in their honouring of the writing's roots in its original language, for the bringing of it to life in its new language, its new hometown, and into a whole new body of work, which has to be perfectly at home in that new language, that other place. The translator as writer. The translator is creative and literary and critical thinker. The book as shared related object. The languages as shared and related physical and metaphysical constructs too. Literary translation asks huge input. It asks a kind of osmosis of the self and a kind of communal fluidity of metamorphosis between writers and books. So I think literary translators are not paid enough. I think translators of major writers pretty much have to be major writers themselves. They have to be equal to major writers, so they are major writers. We just haven't thought how to recognise that yet. Now, you'd expect me in a talk like this one to dwell on the usual obvious, the tiny percentage we translate in the UK if we're talking literary translation. You'd expect me to list all the texts from Gilgamesh via the Bible to Homer and Sophocles and Ovid and Dante and Ariosto and Goethe and Rilke and the Russians and Flaubert and Proust and everyone else who's made English what it is and literature what it is, never mind religion what it is and tragedy and comedy what they are and love what it is and story what it is and the concept of the modern what it is and the concept of the ancient what it is and the concepts of civilization and its contents and discontents what they are. I'm not going to dwell on the obvious, which is that books are produced by books, and every writer, great or minor, using English is or has been writing books which have been formed by the world's great books, in English and in translation, and by the ways in which language is never solitary. I'm not going to list all the great novels we would never have been able to read if it hadn't been for translation, but they are a negligible fraction of a single flake of skin on the body of all the great novels that we've never been able to read that have never or haven't yet been translated into English. Instead, I'm going to say, how do we measure where and who we are in the world in the context of the Western world's increasingly shallowing sea of constant surface information and its increasingly reductive ways of identifying us human beings by barcodes in hospitals on our wrists, by numbers on passports, by information in computer files and by facial recognition technology, by credit checks and credit cards and bank details on all of us, in which we exist only as a string of digits. I'm going to say, too, how do we know anything, ever, if we don't look beyond ourselves? Looking dimensionally at ourselves, then looking imaginatively beyond ourselves, is the joint first blessing, first gift, and first act of every single literary text. This is what I think. It doesn't sound that radical, but it would take and it would make a change so radical in our educations that everything would change. Yet it's so obvious, it makes such common sense, that from the earliest age onwards, from the beginning of primary education upwards, we should be positively encouraging language and basic translation skills. I mean, we should be teaching both other languages and translation skills in all our primary schools as part of the basic curriculum, when our children's brains are still so close to the ages at which language structures sink into us like butter into toast or vitamins into the physiology. Why would we deny our children an ability to understand and know something about the languages of the world? We should be teaching both translation and literary translation, both forms, throughout secondary schooling. Why would we deny our young people the literatures of the world and how to work with and understand the subtleties of the world's proliferation of languages? And we should have in every tertiary education institution, college or university, a literary translation centre. Why would we deny our culture and our most fully educated generations the literatures and languages of the world? The pretty unradical truth is languages, and specifically the study of their literatures, like the humanities, are being here less and less valued in our schools and universities. Universities have been paring back their language studies and the serious study of literatures in different languages, mainly in favour of the languages it pays most money to teach and in favour of the ways in which those ways of teaching them will raise or make in the end the most and fastest money. But language is about a different kind of worth. Languages are bigger than money. They're organic forms. They live and die like we do. They signal things on the same level of importance that words like life and death do. Words like identity, cultural understanding, cultural survival. And do we not live in a shared world? Well, yes, the thing is we do, no matter how much localised and globalised politics might like to suggest otherwise, or to patrol the borders between districts and countries, that the birds above our heads soar naturally straight over, and the fish in our rivers, as José Saramago notes in one of his earliest texts, swim right across without a passport problem. Is it not telling, shaming, and, well, idiotic, that almost every time there's a new literary Nobel Prize winner announced, so little, if any, of that person's output is usually available or in print in the UK, a writer probably hugely popular in his or her own country, as well as available in all the other countries, and we watch our publishing and media industry scramble just to keep up? I have to compare it with how my own books are treated abroad, with knowledge, with acceptance, with welcome. I'm not an easy writer to translate, and I can't believe the number of countries open to translating books like mine, while here in the country I live in, I'm left ostensibly practically shut out of almost all those countries, left at sea by my own culture when it comes to their writing and their literary histories. It's pretty simple correlation. It's pretty simple stuff. Simple as breathing. Just go into a bookshop in Italy, France, Romania, Spain, Estonia, and you will see everywhere the names of our writers, contemporary and classic, all over the shop. And they're there, an international company that's itself both contemporary and classic. It's shaming to come home to the general lack of international company we're able to keep in the average UK bookshop. But how exciting it has been. to watch this really shift and change, especially over the past decade, while the independents, both publishers and booksellers, backed up by an excitement of readers and a pressure of good bloggers, have been finding and defining and answering the natural reader excitement for books of all sorts in the market. The independent publishers know, they knew all along that readers are adventurous and will always want to read the whole world. The work of the independents in this has pressurised and is pressurising and opening up the larger conglomerates and the media's take on more borderless reading as we speak. The independents are stalwart, risk-taking, ahead of the game, as always. And the range of books available is growing precisely because of their work. I'll say it again, things are changing. They're better than they were. We have to make sure that keeps happening. I'm not going to list all the independent publishers here because this is exciting in itself. When I looked it up today, I thought it would take too long. But what they're doing, it gives me a frisson of the very Ovidian ecstatic that I believe good translation itself is. An understanding of the things that can change and an understanding of what we share, of what's common between us, change and the communal. Those are the concepts that drive any and all translation. Over the past few weeks, I've been rereading work by the great German writer W.J. Sebald. I was taking part in the launch of a book celebrating his work and his legacy. In the reread, I realised again how much and how deeply language, for Sebald, is always a matter of ethics. As he describes it, language and ethics can't be divided. Language is an ethical issue, and ethical issues rise, hold true, and fall or fail directly via the rhetorics of the language a culture commonly uses every day, as pivotal as its breathing pattern. Sebald, of course, was himself a pivotal part of the creation of the British Centre for Literary Translation at UEA. He was its founding director. For his whole writing life, he knew that books were a communal matter, and he made his own books studiedly communal matters. In them, he walked, you might say, constantly by the sides of other writers and artists, especially a writer like Walter Benjamin, a victim of the language and the ethics of the Nazis and of the time that Sebald's work continually addresses and revolves around. Benjamin's notion about the languages of the world is also an ethical matter. Benjamin believed that all the world's languages are and have always been part of the single family of language and exist always in a related state to each other. Not to translate, not to connect, goes against the very nature of language. I might even call it ethically wrong to block that connecting or not to honour translation. But we're living in times whose tenor when it comes to the global is reductive. The times are increasingly vocally anti-European and anti-internationalist. I am neither of these things. I think they're idiotic. I believe that without translation we lose meaning and related meaning and relativity and relation. But then I am a lover of words. They're the most sophisticated of our connective tools and I love their behaviours, their mischievous slippage of meaning, their endless self-inventiveness, their deep, deep roots. The other day I was talking to a friend. We were talking about how now that we were both parentless, and, you know, she said, didn't that make us both orphans? And I said, I didn't think so, because didn't orphan mean a child state? And we were talking about how one of my brothers, after the death of my father and his, our father, about 5 years ago, had written to me to tell me that he and I were now two little orphans. I should explain this word. You know, the two little orphans has a kind of family frisson for me and my brother, because when we were kids, my mother used to terrorise us after our Saturday bath by singing in a dolefully melodramatic voice, especially to make us cry, a song, a Victorian song called Two Little Orphans, a boy and a girl sat by the old church door. They were left at the church door. Now their mother's dead and their father's a sailor and he's never returned from his last voyage. And the song goes on and the next morning they're found next morning still on the step. They're dead now and they've got a slight sprinkling of snow over them. You know, so much for communal responsibility. Anyway, being a bookish wordy geek, or rather a bit literary, I looked up the etymology of the word orphan. It's quite exciting. I looked it up by chance. It's the root of Orpheus, of course, never even thought of that. Around about 1300, from late Latin orphanus, parentless child, old French orfeno, Italian orfano, from Greek orphanos, orphaned, without parents, fatherless, literally deprived, from orphos, bereft. Cognates, Hittite, harb, change allegiance, Latin orbis, bereft, Sanskrit, arba, weak, child, Armenian orb, orphan, Old Irish orba, heir, Old Church Slavonic, rabu, slave, rabota, servitude, see, robot, Gothic arbia, German erbe, Old English erfa, heir, Old High German arbeit, going to German arbeit, work, Old Frisian arbed, Old English erfath, hardship, suffering, trouble. Languages at all levels, all you have to do is and look and they display relation. They have each other in common. They are family. The word idiot is also interesting etymologically. early 14th century, person so mentally deficient as to be incapable of ordinary reasoning. Also in Middle English, simple man, an educated person, layman. From Old French, idiot, an educated or ignorant person. From Latin, idiota, ordinary person, layman or outsider. From Greek, idiotes, layman, person lacking profession or skill, opposed to writer, soldier, skilled workman, literally meaning private person as opposed to one taking part in public affairs, used patronisingly for ignorant person, from idios, meaning one's own. Do we want to be idiots? Do we want to be this insular, orphaned, left robotic, on our own, outsiders, irresponsible and irresponsive when it comes to the world beyond ourselves? Why would we not embrace the full cultural possibilities and interlayerings and interpretations of our shared and different and changing and unchanging human, cultural, geographical, earthly and metaphysical identities, the imaginative identities of all our norths, souths, easts and wests? I can't be alone in seeing the very notion of the act of translation as a human moral responsibility, and in seeing the UK publishing industry's reticence to deal with the notion as a hangover of the imperial. We need to know what's happening in the world's literatures. How else will we know what's really happening in the world's mind, in its spirit, in its connective tissues, in its nervous system, in its history, in its everyday, in its context? Without literature, a ravaged context, thinned and surfaced. With literature, an understanding that is stratified, that goes to the roots of what and how things mean and have come to mean. Anyway, here's my conclusion. Deep breath. The word translation and the fundamental importance, naturalist and breathing, mechanism of the act, we've dealt with. The word literary, people tend to go in fear of it, of what it connotes, in a country that's still not as easy as it ought to be, with its notions of intellectual, late 14th century, grasped by the understanding, rather than the senses from Old French, intellectuel, and directly from Latin, intellectualis, relating to the understanding, discernment, understanding. If we value literature at all, then we know the worth of literary translation. If we want language to be as subtle and supple and layered and resonant as language can be, then we know the worth and the work and the subtlety of literary translation. If we care at all about looking beyond our backyard, our own dominant narratives, then we know the worth, the work, the open border, open mind, open eyes and ears of literary translation. If we belong to a culture which rates the word literary, then we know the value, the scope, the touchstone, the creativity, the generosity in this fusion of the words literary and translation. If we consider the tiny percentage of translated literary works published compared to everything else in the UK's literary publishing output every year, then we'll be entitled to feel sober, ashamed, cheated, excluded from whole worlds. If we work against this, then we'll be a lot richer in the end when it comes to world and worlds. If we recognise that a country in all its history and all its contemporaneity can be seen, revealed, understood precisely by recourse to its literature, and if we can see that all human languages belong to and with each other, exist in the one huge borderless country of language, then it's obvious, even just at a glance, the importance of, the excitingness of, and above all, the imperative in the act of literary translation.
Well, that was quite good, wasn't it? Who'd have thought? That was extraordinary. I'm going to, in a moment, ask Charlotte and Margaret to attempt to respond to that. I'm going to allow you to breathe very quickly. I'm going to ask Ali just one question that occurred to me while you were talking. I should also say that I assume that every other translator in the room, like me, while you were describing what translators do, was thinking, is that really very clever, aren't I? It sounds great, doesn't it?
You bloody are clever.
Excellent. It's very good to know. Somewhat surprising to some of us. I want to ask you, Ali, just one thing before I ask Shalu and Margaret to respond. You talk about living in language, and you talk about, I think you use the phrase, the slippage of meaning. What's interesting to me, you said that you are translated into all these languages, and you acknowledge that you're not an easy writer to translate. What occurs to me reading you is that there's also a great precision in what you're doing when you write. And therefore, for a writer whose work is so embedded in language, who is so much about what you are doing with the texture of the words, the way you can tease a word and play with a word. You seem like a very unlikely person to believe in the possibility of your work being able to be extracted entirely from language.
The point of writing a book isn't the whole point of writing a book is for it to be translated. I've always thought that, and I've always believed it. The excitement for me at the very thought that something which seems so pinned down can be shifted, can be made fluid, can be metamorphosed, can be changed into a language in which the same things can happen, but in its own language. I'm thinking now of the translator who does my books in Norwegian, whose name is Merete Olsen, and who, for my luck, translates Wolf and Austin. I mean, you know, she's the writer who retranslated Wolf's earlier. There was an earlier version of To the Lighthouse in Norwegian, and it was called They Went to the Lighthouse, which she, as she said, gave it away rather. So she redressed this with her own her translations of Wolf, and of course it's called To the Lighthouse. She found, and she's a writer who occasionally will send me an email after a book saying, "That's it, I give up. I can't do it. It's impossible. I can't do this one." And then 2 weeks later, I'll get another email from Merete, and she'll say, "I've got it." And actually, that's it. That's it. It's about not giving up. It's about the fact that the thing can be found, and she'll simply have found the shift into Norwegian that is the right shift for the book. And then, you know, she asked my permission. She doesn't need to ask my permission. You know, translators can really do what they like, as far as I'm concerned, with my writing. I trust translators. She says, "Can I change this to this? Can I move this to this? If I make this song into this song, it's a Norwegian song, then we'll get all of these complications which will just arise from the resonance from that particular, using that particular joke or song." And I'm like, "Yeah, that would be great." And then I go to Norway and I hear her read, and I just know that she's just a superb writer. And, you know, and that, to me, that's the right commerce, correspondence. Yeah.
The trust is important, then. Is this something your translators have to earn, or have you always just assumed that?
No.
Because these must be things that are precious to you somehow.
I'm just saying that the difference between They Went to the Lighthouse and To the Lighthouse is that someone somewhere along the way goes, no, that's not how to do that. That's how to do that. So that if someone's getting it wrong for mine, and I can't tell because I only speak, 14-year-old French and German, then somewhere along the line, someone will say, no, that's not right for that. And if this book deserves to be translated again, it just will. I have the faith of it. Let it go, And let it go and let it become whatever it's going to be in the world.
You can tell from Margaret's expression when you were saying that this is not a common experience of working with authors.
But it is quite a common experience, actually. I mean, but it's lovely to hear you say that, because it is such a relationship of trust between the writer and the translator. Because if I do a bad translation, and especially into English, which is such a huge language in the world, then I'm letting down that author. I might be ruining that author's future, as a world author. So it's so important to have that trust. And one of the great pleasures, I think, of translating is, assuming your author is alive, is that you do have that contact with them, and it's that pleasure of winning their trust, in a way, which is so lovely when an author says, "Yeah, that sounds like me," in English, That's the ultimate accolade, really. So it's a huge pleasure to hear you say that, because we translators, we are kind of subsidiaries of authors, we're the second violin, really. But we're also important in that translating literally from one language to another, from one culture to another. So it's lovely to hear you say that, yeah.
Margaret, did you recognise what Ali was saying about a change in the way translations talked about, thought about, practised here in recent years?
I think in reviews that there's more of a tendency to mention the translator and the translation. But there's a great fear, I think, on the part of reviewers. They don't know what to say because they say, "Well, I don't know that. I don't know the original language, therefore I can't comment." But I think that's less, maybe, now. Maybe they accept that, as you say, it's a work, this is a new work.
Yeah.
And so you've got to review that book on its own merits, really, as an English book, as an English language book.
Good. Exactly.
Yeah. I think there's a slight change.
Shalu.
I think for most writers, definitely the language is identity, because the words are the real, the only tool for us. So this is a question I ask myself since I moved to England from China since 2002. So if the language is identity for me, then could I possess two identities at the same time, or perhaps three? And I did start to learn French after I learned English, and then I started to learn German since I lived in Germany for a bit. Then the result is, yes, I can possess two identities, and that's very interesting because I've been writing both in Chinese and in English for the last 13 years. Although I published more Chinese novels than I published my English novels because I only lived in Britain for the last 12, 11 years. So your political identity starts separate from your cultural identity because I write in English now. Originally, I thought I was a Chinese writer, so because the political identity and the cultural identity seems to be together. Now, my cultural reference is more like I feel like I'm much more influenced from, for example, Italo Calvino than more from Confucius, for example, if we talk about cultural identity. When I read the Latin American literature, I felt so close to Latinos, the mentality, the metaphor of the plots, the language usage. I felt so much a part of that tradition. So my cultural identity taking over my political reference. Therefore, I began to play the writers in my book. For example, in my recent book, I Am China, in order to write about writers' confusion in between different culture and language, I had to invent a character who is a translator. So swim in between Chinese and English, try to mistranslate or translate, because mistranslation is also a method to enter another culture. But anyway, my personal experience, you really get play different personality and even morality in different books. For the last five novels I wrote in English, each time I play some kind of a naughty trick, you know, either with broken language or some kind of, you know, for example, sexuality, which I never really wrote when I was in China, some forbidden subject. So, yes, your simple question might be, what do you feel really, you know, prisoned, not free, writing second language? And I said, yeah, what's the first language? You know, perhaps I write in Chinese much freer in a technical way, you know, technically much freer in Chinese. But morally and politically, I might feel very, very refrained and restrained by that problem, you know, because the implication is too big. So I would be self-censorship all the time. Now, I write in English. I achieve much more kind of moral freedom and political freedom, you know, although technically it's very difficult. So this identity, you know, you get to play, which is quite interesting. Another thing I think, you know, it's very personal. Since I write in English in the last 10 years, I constantly meet, I feel this alphabet versus pictogram or ideogram.
Yes.
Because it's so remote, the Chinese language, you know, compared with to your European language, you know, and I often say, well, I make a joke, you know, between Italian and Spanish, you just change the order of the alphabet, A, B, C, D, you know, 26 times, you know, you can change order. Of course, this is a lazy way to say, but imagine, you know, the Chinese language is pictogram, is ideogram. It's nothing to do with the alphabet, A, B, C, D, F, G. So this layer of translation going on, you know, the picturalize it, visualize it, you know, from S-U-N sound to the real sound in Chinese. And, you know, this is beyond, you know, technical translation. Of course, all the translations is emotional, meaningful, it's all multi-layered. But again, I think that this is so remote for me. I no longer talk about the difference between Chinese and English. You know, it's really, you're going through such a heavy mental journey that you have to remove the old you totally in order to write a book, which I find extremely free and really fascinating for me to be a real writer. And I actually find myself, you know, a totally new writer since I came to this country, and I write very differently. So that's a quite personal experience. Actually, I wanted to mention these translations and just to respond to Ali's talk. I mean, we know, you know, there's inequality, the you know, there's about 1.5 billion Chinese speakers and 500 million English speakers, about 400 million Spanish speakers. But, you know, in terms of the translation, the quantity of translation, mainly we're reading Anglo-Saxon, the Anglophone literature. That's for sure. Those numbers are very, you know, common. You all know these numbers, and the translators here know very well. But for some readers, maybe you still need to know these numbers. In the world, there's books in translation. In the East European country, for example, Slovenia or in Poland, 70% of books are translated, you know, foreign literature translated into East Europe. In Turkey, it's 40% foreign titles. In Spain, it's 28%. In France, 27%. In Germany, 13%. Britain, American, we know the number, 2%. And for me, this is significant because we know, you know, a fourth of this planet is speaking Chinese, but yet, really, I mean, we are reading really English-American literature, really. In China, the last year, we have these statistics. For the last 10 bestseller books from foreign country other than China. So these are quite interesting, yeah? So last year, I just say five titles translated into Chinese which hit the bestseller. Bestseller in China meaning, you know, more than a million or 20 million. I'm just saying random random numbers. So it's Ali's dream to be very rich in China. We're gonna yeah. But number one, it's not Alice Smith yet, so it's J.K. Rowling, it's The Casual Vacancy. It's 2.5 million Chinese copies sold last year. Number two, thank you, Spanish translation, Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude. That's wonderful. So that's, you know, old stuff, but still selling. It's 962,000, nearly a million last year sold. Number three, of course, Steve Jobs, yeah, this biography, which is good. I think it's good, you know, in China. They can make money in China. Well, why not? Number four, surprisingly, number four bestseller in China is this French children book called La Petite Poule, The Little Chicken, by this... It's a children book by these two French authors, which I think is wonderful. It's nearly more than half a billion copies sold in China. And number five is a Japanese author, Murakami, of course. You know, the lots of Japanese authors work really well in Chinese translation because of the closeness of the language. So that's the top five, which for me I think is rather healthy, you know, for a country like China. It's not only fiction, not only Dan Brown. Dan Brown is not even in the list. Great, you know. So poor, I'm just saying, Dan, you know, eh? You know, get China on the case, and I think you can make lots of money, and we talk about equality.
So the moral of that, yeah, I'm not going to actually work out what the moral of that story is, but I'm interested that you talked, Shella, about the numbers, and as you say, we all know that if you look at just how much we publish in this country compared to how much you publish in other places in translation, we are a little bit embarrassing, just a little bit. But one thing which was interesting when Ali you were talking is you're talking about great writers, you're talking about Nobel Prize winners. Something sounded like you weren't talking about quantity, but you're talking about quality. And I wonder to what extent this conversation about numbers, which we have all the time, we're endlessly talking about how do we get from 2.5 to 3.7%, whether we actually mean translating anything is better than translating nothing, or are we saying there are a certain number of really good writers, there are certain things that we are missing. And those seem to me, Ali, to be quite different ways of thinking about a problem which we recognise.
Yeah, but they're connected. And that's why I suggested the wild, mad suggestion of us actually learning how to translate from a very young age. Mm. I mean, and then I don't know. I look at Canada. I look at its film industry, and I look at how they went out of their way to make a film industry by suggesting that there should always be a quotient number of Canadian films made in Canada, and it just made a film industry, and it is brilliant, you know, to have been able to do that. If we, as a society, went about translation is one of our root acts in the, at the centre of education, then it, you know, everything in, on either end of that seesaw level would simply change. Mm. Yeah.
Now, I mean, I do agree with what you're saying about how important, well, how you learn to write when you translate. Mm. You know, I'm very pro. I mean, they're bringing back teaching French now in primary schools after cancelling and then bringing it back. But the way they teach language now, it's not really about language so much. It's about what they call communication skills. So it means you can say, you know, where is the bank and things like that. Mm. But that isn't what translation is about. Mm-hmm. Translation is about language. It's about understanding what you can do in your own language. Mm. And so I would love it if they could bring in... But they, obviously, if you bring in translation in primary schools or later in primary schools, the children have got to read in English a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so it's all combined. They're both intimately linked. You know, translation and writing, original writing, you can't separate them, I don't think.
Yeah, that's true. I'm also remembering that when I was a kid, Gaelic had practically died out. Mm. Gaelic was beginning to be taught. Within the 10 years of me finishing school and doing university, Gaelic had come back to life because of that. Simply because it, you know, because it existed on the curriculum and people took it, and more people took it. And it, you know, in that, I mean, you have a language in all its levels, because the teaching they were doing was incredibly kind of culture stimulating, based in poetry and song and music and story as well. I mean, it's kind of unavoidable, really, as soon as you start to look at a language, you know, to find its subtleties that exciting.
Mm.
And I think if we just as a society addressed our human ability to take on board the different structures of language at a very early age, different languages, structures and subtleties at the next age, and then, like I say, if every one of our tertiary education places had a literary translation centre, my God, we'd see the books come out of there, you know, and we'd be open to them, we'd be looking for them, and even more than we are now.
But as Margaret said, it's partly to do with the way it has been taught rather than the fact that it's being taught or not, because in fact translation is used as a teaching tool for language and has always been, but it's been used as a way essentially of ascertaining whether your student has got the data or not.
Yeah.
Has the student actually understood this, rather than as a part of creative writing, a kind of writing.
Yeah.
You can write novels, you can write translations, you can write poems. It's one kind of constraint within your writing.
And I think with O-level, not O-level, sorry, I'm showing my age, GCSE and A-level, when they teach languages now, there's far less reading,
I know.
You know, in French or Spanish or Chinese, whatever. So until they bring that back, I think you're not learning a language unless you're learning the literature.
I'd like to talk a little bit about if we were to look at these... however many percent it is we have in English, but have some thought about what it is that is being translated, what is being translated and what is not. So not just the amount of it, but what kind of things are coming to English, and particularly whether there are certain kinds of things that we are aware that we're missing. Charlotte, maybe I'll ask you first, whether, as someone who reads other languages, whether you're aware of particular gaps, whether you're aware of particular kinds of things that make the transit more easily than others.
Yeah, I mean, from industry point of view, I think if I'm a mega publisher, big publisher, of course, fiction is the last thing to translate. In a way, we are in such age of, you know, functional, the self-help book, you know, how to cook, you know, Italian, you know, how to cook Chinese. Those books first translated, and how to get a MBA. I think in China, it's really... those are books, you know, on the front desk if you enter a Chinese bookshop in China. But in that sense, you know, here is really not the worst place. You get to see the fiction on the front desk here. So in a way, we talk about literary translations, really talk about kind of high language skill. Is not just speaking spoken language. It's a words manipulation of elegant words in certain kind of sophisticated level, and this is really, you need to go to school to study. So this is very difficult to achieve, you know, from commercial point of view, or from mass education point of view. We talk about education here. I think it's also self-help book. You know, if you go to France, you buy a little book, you know, how to speak French in one day so you can pay in the bar. Or that. I think those language books, in a way, flattened the difference in between language, because the key is actually the difference. For me, it's not a common thing. Although, you know, we all know Noam Chomsky say, in the deep sense, you know, we have universal grammar line underneath a different language. But you know, universal grammar doesn't help the translators. When you work on the translation, it's a specific language and difference. And it's like the Swiss linguist Saussure said, you know, what the identity of a word is from the difference with the other word. Therefore, one word achieves its own identity because of the difference with the other word. So I think this is very difficult to know exactly the difference between you know, the red in Italian or the red in French, red in Chinese, you know, the layer of the difference. If we understand that, then in a way, you know, that is a deep level of education. And I think the industry always, of course, you know, far behind, the industry doing something much quicker, much more useful, functional, which I think, in a way, you know, writer and translator has no power to arrive that layer, to push our word, what we preferred, you know, to the industry level.
Could one make the case? I'm going to attempt to provoke back. Could one make the case that there is potentially a sort of flattening that happens when there is a lot of translation? That the fact that the bestseller list in China is not full of Chinese books, for example, that actually there is some damage done to what is distinct about some of the writing. And I'm just asking this partly because I think we all sort of instinctively feel anxious about globalization when it goes too far. And at the same time, we want everyone to be able to read the same things.
I wonder whether this
actually has an impact on some of the writing.
I do have the opposite thing to say to Ali, you know, just to provoke, you know, properly. But anyway, in a way, you know, I have more... I guess I maybe have some kind of, a bit, you know, I would say anarchy attitude towards language, because if from a long-term evolutionary point of view, for example, English language, the English people speak 1,000 years ago, so little to do with English speaking now. Mm. In a way, the language is such a dynamic self-orgasm, and it grows and it disappears. You can't really, you know, an ideological government cannot really control its usage, you know, so you can't clean up or you can't just... because political implication, you clean up or you use certain language. So I found that, for example, the English language is the most ambiguous language. You cannot just use it for the ideological purpose. When we talk about English literature, we're not talking about British literature. We talk about, okay, people in Singapore writing English, people like me writing English, people in South Africa, people in America, people in Canada.
People in Scotland.
So it's such blur.
people in all the parts of...
Exactly. I mean, you know, you can localize, say, this is a consequence of a colonial history, but that's, we talk about the last 300 years. And I think if you look much longer term, you know, 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years later, perhaps you know, your grandchildren will be writing, speaking in Chinese. But that Chinese is nothing to do with Chinese we're speaking now. Perhaps a much more Africano language than Chinese language, because most Chinese, perhaps, immigrants occupied Africa, for example. So what I try to say is language is ever-changing, self-evolutionary, persistent revolution, you know. So within English language, there's always constant revolution, too. So in a way, I don't worry too much, you know, the people not get translated, or the new generation only writing in English like me.
Yeah.
Because it's dynamic revolution.
It's exciting. Yeah. I think it's endlessly exciting. I think it's just, I think language is exactly that. I think it's always alive. It's always exciting. Whenever we think that we're going to keep it down, it will spring back up at us. And whenever we think we've got it pinned, off it will go and do its own thing. It's really exciting.
But isn't that also, paradoxically, isn't that also what the translator's trying to do? The translator's trying to stop it moving for just a moment.
Just for that moment.
Just kill the thing for a second.
No,
just pin it down.
No,
you know what I mean, though. It's somehow, you're going to... I don't really mean that. That'd be ridiculous. but you want to somehow... You want something alive, of course. But you also... When Margaret's translating, she has to translate into... a particular English at a particular time.
Nobody has translated into an English like Margaret translated. Margaret has found new kinds of English. That's what translators can do. They can actually shift the language forward. They can do that revolution. They can keep that life going. They can actually reignite the Englishness of English with a whole new kind of English.
I'm not talking about myself, but I think
but yes, it's true.
At least we inform. But that's exactly what happens. Yeah.
We need T-shirts, I think.
Yeah. I think as a translator, you're kind of conserving your own language because you're using a very wide vocabulary, which I feel is kind of shrinking in lots of people's normal usage. Yeah. So you're conserving vocabulary, but you're also, because of whatever your author is doing with language, you've got to find new ways of saying that in English, new ways of saying all kinds of things in English. So it's both ways. I think a translator both conserves and advances the language. You know, so it's a
change and movement.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think come back to what you said, what gets translated, what not. It's so much to do with economical power. You know, we know very little African literature or, say, Arabic literature being translated or East Asian literature, Japanese, Chinese literature. Yet I'm just saying the Chinese population is the largest, you know, it's a fifth of the world population, but so little Chinese book you really read this year. So the quantity, the biggest quantity, always Swedish thriller, Danish thriller, or Norwegian murder story, you know, those are every year when, if you have a chance to be like a judge of independent foreign fiction prize, you know, 90% are Scandinavia thriller translation. Mm-hmm. One book from Arabic country. Yeah. Maybe one little novel written in Africano. Two from East Asia, which is basically the whole humanity lived there. But And that's the balance, you know. You know there's no balance. And who we can blame? It comes back, you know, to the banker's problem, you know, economic order first.
Yeah. Yeah. But this was kind of behind my question about things getting flattened out. Mm-hmm. Ali used the word imperial at one point as a way, as a sort of when we're thinking about, why we have this problem. And one of the things we know is that writers from the Arabic-speaking world and indeed writers from China and other places are expected to write a certain kind of Northern European novel. That the expectation is actually that the way of getting published, if you're a writer in Arabic, is to write the kind of novel that we sort of recognize, the 11 of us who live in this part of the world. Yeah. We have to be able to recognize that. And that must do some damage to what you might call a sort of indigenous way of writing, I would have thought. That it's not such a problem if you're working with European languages, even if they're European languages in Latin America, because the Latin American novel is the European novel, we recognize where it comes from.
Yeah,
but there
sure,
must be
something
in that expectation which is a problem.
Absolutely. The last 200 years, I think the narrative, the mainstream narrative, is Western narrative. If you argue, you know, with your novel, what this is particular, you know, Vietnamese style or Chinese style, well, it doesn't matter. You're not really going to get published properly. So that's the situation now. You know, the narrative really reflects the imperial power, definitely. But doesn't mean that next 200 years will be this narrative. Perhaps it will be the other narrative. Mm. So, you know.
Well, I do, with the crime fiction thing, I think in a way it does affect other cultures because publishers here will publish crime fiction from almost any language. And so I think in Spain and in Portugal as well, I think there's a lot of crime fiction being written which wouldn't have been written before.
Yeah.
It's always been such an English, the detective fiction has always been, apart from Edgar Allan Poe, it's been a very English, British thing. And now it seems to have spread like a rash, you know.
Someone was telling me yesterday, a translator of Swedish crime novels, that the pressure to translate these novels as fast as possible for the English market is actually horrific. Yeah. And that, you know, you really have to churn it out. Mm. You know?
Which is not good.
No.
But that's also, then it becomes less interested in the quality of the craft and the living thing that you're making. Mm. And it then becomes a product which you're selling like anything
product,
else.
Yep, money.
And there's some translator I want to mention here because I really respect those kind of translators and writers. For example, the Chinese translator for James Joyce, Finnegan's Wake, 10 years passed, she's still translating. You know, the second half still not come out yet. And we were talking about this, you know, her life basically lived through that book. And although actually the first part, Finnegan's Wake, already published in China last year, and it was really quite...
And sold how many copies?
Nearly a million, a lot. I mean, you know, but she's still translating the second half of Finnegan's Wake, and those people are really important because the culture plays such a role. And also, you know, in the old days, for example, Ezra Pound, and I always think Ezra Pound actually, although, you know, he was very being kind of diminished because his fascist movement, but he was one of the first Western translator who translated all the Chinese Tang Dynasty poetry and Confucius' big masterpiece work. And he was one, he invented the idea of imagism in the poetry movement because that's the direct result he learned from translation Chinese poetry. And he said, actually, you know, my poetry movement, the image movement, imagism is based on that, my Chinese knowledge. So these figures, I think, really important. You know, Margaret, you should do a cultural movement, you know, from your Spanish knowledge. Yeah.
We need to give you more revolution. Medals for things.
Before we came through the back, Xiaolu and Danny were talking about that translator of the first part of Finnegan's Wake, and apparently she's lost some husbands and all her teeth doing that first half of Finnegan's Wake, and she's still doing the second half of Finnegan's Wake.
For anyone who is actually thinking about becoming a literary translator in there. we've actually slightly passed the hour mark, and I want to allow... When Ali was talking, I made enough notes for like 7 hours of conversation, but we don't have 7 hours, so I'm going to, I think, encourage you to join the conversation now, because, as I said, we've had more than an hour already. So we have microphones... So I'm going to... Excellent. There is one just there. I don't know where the microphones are. Who's got the microphones? There they are.
I'm not aware of a microphone. The production gives you one. Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Great. There was someone there in the second row of that section there. And then we can go back.
Hi. I was interested in what Xiaolu said about Ezra Pound, because as I understand it, he didn't really speak Chinese very well, and he was relying on an Italian writer so he was translating Italian, translating Chinese, and it wasn't always very accurate, and then he sort of did something else entirely anyway, very sort of creatively with what he'd got. And I was wondering about what you all thought of the sort of function of mistranslation and translating badly, whether it's still worth doing and why it is, why it might be worth doing.
Yeah. In Ezra Pound's case, he doesn't speak Chinese, and he uses Italian manuscript his friend gave to him, because a friend passed away, the Chinese expert sinologist. So he used that to recreate the translation, which is why I think so poetic, less technical, because most Chinese translation from ancient literature to the Western literature always reads so technically impossible. You can't really enter the poetic rhythm at all. So his translation on the Tang Dynasty poetry, I think, is the best, because he didn't know Chinese. And I think, what a great thing. Because I think you definitely have mistranslation, but I don't like this word misinterpretation or mistranslation, because all the translation is personal, is very personal, implicated, you know, your cultural background, your... For example, the Chinese translator for Murakami's book, all Murakami book in China is, of course, bestseller as it is here, but the Murakami translator in China never know what is jazz music or spaghetti, and each... Each book, and he wrote an essay about it. You know, when I lived in China, I was... Because my literature taste grew up purely reading translated literature, you know, Japanese literature, Italian literature, French literature, especially. So my literature education are the translators, whether good or bad. But the Chinese translator on Murakami, he doesn't know what's the Italian opera or spaghetti. He really doesn't know. Now, one day, he wrote an essay. He said, I have to go to a Beijing cafe to eat what's spaghetti like, you know, to translate Murakami. But that, he already translated 8 books, you know, by Murakami. And it doesn't matter. Okay, of course, it doesn't matter. But in a way, you know, the sensibility and the sensuality someone has... It's so kind of being embodied in your work. So a very wet, sensual writer can get very dry, you know, not sensual translation. Mm-hmm. But so what? You know, the other one could have opposite translation. But I always support, you know, the bad translation better than the no translation at all. Because through those process, there will be a better translation based on those historical ground. You know, you need sacrifice, and then you can go better and better.
Ali, if you were told that you're being translated by someone, there's a new translation of How to Be Both, translator doesn't speak English, technically, but has sort of produced something which is joyful and different, and does this make you nervous?
No. Honestly, it makes me quite delighted and excited. I was just thinking about I can't remember the name of the latest Adam Thirlwell translation venture, which was
Multiples,
where writers pass stories between themselves and you know, make different translations of the same story and put them side by side. There's one story in there, and I think I'm right remembering this properly. Try it out if I've got it wrong. Someone sends a story to Sjón, the Icelandic writer, and Sjón translates it, then he tells the story to his son, and then his son tells him the story back, and then he translates that. He just, you know, he tells him 3 days later, he says to his son, what's the story? His son goes, this thing happens, that thing happens, and that thing happens. And then he writes that down, that's the story. That's right, that's how story travels, you know. And if someone, you know, if the book travels at all, if the story travels at all, then, you know, great.
I can't defend bad translation.
You've never been accused of such a thing.
It's not bad translation, so in that case, it's a kind of open, travelling translation.
Yeah,
you know?
But I think what John was saying, that a bad translation is better than nothing, no translation. I mean, I take your point, but if it's a contemporary novel and that's the translation, it will just die, I think. If it's a good translation, there's a chance that people might read it and reviewers will think it's good. But it can be the death of a book, I think, to have a bad translation.
And particularly, presumably, this matters more in English, Margaret, than in a lot of other languages, because English can be the gateway to being translated into other languages.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And a translation that has, in fact, killed off a writer that you think is a wonderful writer can actually become the obstacle to this person getting moving beyond this language.
My point is more like if a writer is a persistent inventor, so one book might die and the next book might come alive again, and the next three books. So, I mean, in my case, like, because I couldn't really wait to be translated. I remember 10 years ago, I said, you know, forget it. I'm just going to self-translate. I'm going to write in my broken English. So I could think, you know, I would be failed right away because I write in broken English in the beginning. But then I had another 5 novels after that, and each time is I improve with my language. So, you know, if you're so fragile, okay, you should die.
We actually do still have a little bit of time, but I would quite like that to have been the last line of the event. Well, thank you all very much for coming. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, we do in fact have time for more questions, but there was someone there about 6 rows back in that section, and then we'll come over to this side. If you could just wave as conspicuously as you can. Thank you.
Hello. My question is quite specific, but I would very much like your opinion on it. I come from Portugal, and for the past 10 years, I've been noticing that the imported amount of books, in the first 10 years, it was a shelf. Today, it is an entire section with English, French, Spanish. And I started to notice this, so I started to pay attention and realize that it's actually a general phenomenon. And I would like to ask your opinion on it, both as translators and as writers. I would also like you to bear in mind the fact that the imported books cost €3, Dickens, Jane Austen, while the translated version costs 10 to 15. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I would like to hear your thoughts on that.
It's a nice, difficult question.
Difficult question.
Thank you.
I really don't know what it is. I mean, I think, I know this, the position of translators in Portugal as well. Ali was saying we should be paid more. I mean, English translators, British translators are paid pretty well, actually. But I know in Portugal, the translators are paid appallingly and have to work at extreme, you know, they have to get something done in a month or something, which is absurd. So I doubt very much if they're getting a royalty. Mm. So, you know, you're saying that the translated books are more expensive than the original. So, I mean, that's disgraceful, is what I can say.
Yes, the entire market is a different shape, isn't it, somehow?
Yeah.
We're going to have to think about that one.
That's a difficult question.
We'll work it out and we will let you know. Another question. Do I see someone on this side? Am I inventing that?
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's. I mean, the King James Bible is. It has mistranslations, as the camel and the needle's eye, for example. But that's a wonderful image. I mean, I think that supports Jalou's position, because that has entered our language. So much of the King James Bible has entered our language, and it may be mistranslated or not. I think for me, writing now, translating now, a bad translation is one that has no life of its own. That doesn't, in its, I want what I want. When I read a good book, what I feel is the pleasure of the language. And so for me, when I translate, I want the reader of my translation to feel that same pleasure in the language, so that they're not aware that this is a translation. I don't mean that I have to be invisible, but that it has personality, it has life, it has breath. In it,
you know. Is it partly a question of what you're translating for and whom you are translating for? Because sometimes you may be translating basically because you need to convey some information. Sometimes you're translating for a particular publisher and you have a sense that your readers want a certain thing. The function of translating the King James Bible is very different to the function of translating a contemporary novel for a literary publisher in the UK now.
Yeah. I guess the most characteristic quality of a book cannot be lost. You know, that would be really bad translation. Otherwise, I think I have very liberal attitude towards all my translated version. For example, the book I wrote called A Concise Chinese English Dictionary for Lovers is based on broken English, and someone from China cannot speak English. So the whole novel is broken English with vocabularies. But the Italian translator decided to remove all the mistakes. So it's all perfect. So every page, every sentence is perfect, and really, that's a really bad translation, because that's the most important quality of that book.
Yes.
And I remember it became bestseller in Germany because a German translator spent 2 more years than I wrote the book, tried to translate into a broken German, because in German grammar you have 4 tenses, or say, you know, 5 tenses, or English have 3 tenses. So which verb? You know, each verb, she has to decide what kind of roundness this verb should be in German. And it was bestseller in Germany. So that is crazy, you know, really. That, in a way, that kind of book is not able to translate here, intranslatable. But, you know, some country died and some country alive, like Margaret said.
Mm-hmm. And that is why I trust translators. Those 2 years that Charlie just mentioned, and Margaret saying,
incredible,
a book, if it's going to be a good translation, not to be able to hold the book, the actual book, in the new language. Mm. That's why I trust translators.
Thank you. Another question. All the way at the back, and then we'll come down here to the fourth row, third row.
I was very gladdened to hear you, Ali, talk about children learning about translation in primary schools. And I just wondered if you meant to learn about translation, to do the translation, or actually to read books in translation?
All three. Really, I think so. I just think, you know, alongside the other things on the basic curriculum, a spectrum of translation just would renew everybody's synapses from childhood onwards.
But if you had to prioritise them,
language. I was simply then I would prioritise the learning of another language, so that by the time you got to secondary school, and the other part of my, you know, changing of the education system had hit in, which was that you would do translation and literary translation, then you would come to it with the structures of your brain able to cope with the structures of other languages.
I think that's absolutely wonderful. But the problem is, in this country, everybody speaks English.
Yep.
Everybody wants to learn English.
It's all right. I know.
And it's, you know, psychologically,
it's a provocation.
Difficult.
You know, it's a dream. It's a making of an ideal.
I think it's a wonderful dream.
It's a dream.
But I do think if you start children young learning a language, that it breaks down that fear.
Yes, you know, I totally agree. Yeah. I think children should learn almost from birth.
It is curious that we not only aren't teaching languages as much as we should, but at the same time we're not translating for children as much as we should.
Yeah.
If we think we're not translating books for adults, I mean, we're translating so much for adults compared to what's being translated for children at the moment. It's in a way a much bigger problem. There was someone on the aisle there, and then I'd like to come forward.
I just think it's interesting following on from that. In my children's primary school, there were 33 languages spoken. So it's interesting we talk about learning, the act of learning, the act of writing in translation and those kind of thoughts processes. But your event's called Living Translation, and actually huge proportion of new people, new English young people, are speaking and living at least two languages. And that's interesting. What are the implications of that? I mean, maybe going back to what Xiaoliu was saying, everyone will speak English again. You know, people do that by generation. But the fact there are so many people living here now who actually do, unlike me, live in at least two languages. Maybe that's going to do it anyway.
I know, it's brilliant that. And that may actually be one of the reasons that literary translation is shifting and that we are seeing more independents take chances on books and readers go, yes, that's what we wanted and we want more of that. I think it's the beginning of a sea change. You know, and if we were clever enough and wise enough, we would go to the root of it and use it. Properly in education.
It's also where our translators, I think, are going to come from. We're not 10, 15 years from now. There will be lots of great young Turkish translators who won't be people who only spoke English at home who went and studied Turkish at university. There'll be people who have, as it were, a genetic connection to the language. That's where the translators from what we call community languages, that's where they're going to be coming from, I think.
But I do feel it's important that language is not just taught as a spoken thing, but as a written and read thing. And that's the thing, I think, that gets missed out.
There's someone here in the third row, and then we'll move right to the front. Please put your hand up. Keep your hand up. Thank you.
What makes it preferable to have a literary translation industry and culture and to put a focus on translation in education rather than educate people, and especially British people, to speak and understand languages, other languages, so that they can read literature in the way that it was written in the first place?
Both.
I would say both.
What advantage does the first one bring?
Because if you learn how to translate into your own language, you learn an awful lot about your own language. But to do that, you've got to read a lot in your own language as well. So I can't really untangle the two. It seems to me they're both equally important. I mean, it's very important that people should be able to write well in their own language and speak well in their own language, both.
And also that they'll lend to each other anyway. And also, as soon as you look at a language, you find all the other languages couched in its words. I mean, it's already happening in the language, in the single language you might use, you know, and you put those two languages together and simply the correspondences would just grow and the subtleties would multiply, you know?
I think if you don't know the other culture, another language, it's very easy, you demonize the other culture. I don't want to be sweeping around, but if you live in America for more than 3 months, you felt... yes, sweeping, please, yeah.
sweep away, it's
actually,
fine.
3 weeks, I lived in New York for 3 weeks, I felt this overwhelming anti-Muslim propaganda tone amongst all the American radio and the TV. So... imagine the presenter can speak Arabic or more Arabic than, you know, other language. Would you demonize another culture so quickly? You would think differently. Yeah. So you have to learn second or third language in order to have the same platform to think how they function.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you want, going back to Margaret's point about these things being interlinked, you also want the translation to be available. You don't just want to count on if people will learn language, that's going to be the only point of access they need to the literature. Because from a purely practical point of view, if you learn great Spanish, you can have Quixote directly, but you still need Russian for Tolstoy, you still need French for Flaubert, and you still need everything for everything else. And we're all going to depend, which is why there is this frustrating paradox that not only are we a country which have a problem with language learning, it's also not being at least supplemented by lots of translation or the other way around. Either would be fine, really. We had someone in the front. We had two people in the front here. And then just wait for the microphone just coming to you, and then I think we'll have to wrap.
Hi. I just wondered what your thoughts are on translators who translated books, so second translations, similar to Lydia Davis, who translated Proust. Mm. Just wondered what your thoughts are on retranslations.
I do that. No, my Basque author, Bernardo Achaga, he writes in Basque,
yeah.
And he translates into Castilian Spanish, and I translate from the Spanish. And I do feel guilty about this. But Bernardo has assured me that it's all right. And
would you ever do it without permission?
I don't know. I would feel uncomfortable.
Hmm.
But he translates his own Basque, and he said, when we were in Edinburgh with him, with Danny as well, and he said, well, he and his wife translate his books into Spanish. And he says they do a rough draft and then they just throw the original away and and translate very freely.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So that's, yeah. And that makes me feel very much freer.
Yeah.
So, and he's like Ali. He says, my translators can do no wrong. They're, you know, it's their book.
Thank you.
To Ali, first off, if you were fluent in French and German, do you think you would choose to read English language books in their French and German translations?
Hmm.
How interesting. Yes, that'd be really interesting.
Yes. or perhaps do you think, if not yourself, then other people in that situation would feel kind of obliged to stick with the originals in a somewhat analogous manner to Benjamin's aura of the original?
I don't know. I'm the kind of person who's interested in more than one version of something, so that if there is more than one version to read, and if I could read them, I'd like to put them all together and see what came of it. I mean, I know, you know, not enough of us have enough time to do that kind of thing, and it's quite hard to find time to do that kind of thing, but that would be exciting. So, you know, first off, reply, I'd find that very stimulating.
Thank you. Let's have a very quick last question, just on the front aisle there.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, just bellow at us.
The word which didn't come up at all, which is very interesting, is interpretation. Do you think that the resistance to translation into English has to do with the fear of interpretation? Because English is such a linear language. It's rich in vocabulary, but very simple and basic in grammatical structure in comparison with other languages, which, of course, is related then to interpretation. So do you think there's a general fear of interpretation?
I don't separate out translation and interpretation. Inevitably, you have to interpret. I can't really see the difference. I'm sorry.
But is part of that connected then to the question of translators being expected not to be visible, because we have to pretend that what we're getting is something which is pure and uninterpreted and unmediated. And so this idea that translators, ideally, their names are certainly not on the cover, if they have to be on the title page, they're in as small font as you could possibly do, in order that we can kind of pretend this thing that it's not an interpretation, we're getting something which is identical and pure and somehow...
Yeah, but that's exactly my point.
Yeah,
you can't.
Yeah.
The moment you translate, the moment you speak, we interpret.
Well, that's what I mean. I can't separate the two out, translating and interpreting, because everything you read, I mean, I have to interpret what that means, but then it also is passing through all my experiences, all my language, all my culture.
But I wasn't actually talking about you. I was just... Generally.
Yes.
As a culture.
Do you think that English people don't want to read translations or to go to translation because that translation might be wrong, from
mediated by something?
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I just think generally this fear of, you know, because the moment we say anything, it can be interpreted in X amount of ways, and all of the interpretations and all of the, that they're correct. There's no right and wrong. And this is what I find, for example, interesting whenever there's a discussion about translation, that we immediately end up talking about right or wrong translation, good or bad translation. And it's all in the eye of the interpreter. What I might think is a good translation, somebody else might think is a bad translation.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's just a different way of interpreting. And so to accept within the culture
I think that's why we have different meanings.
That's why it's exactly it's very interesting. Whenever you have two cultures, there's comparison, there's a layers of censorship and a moral acceptance. How do you treat that text if for controversial subject? I think that's amazing, fascinating area. Very, you know, I think the publisher or the, you know, some kind of government would censor out, or your translator yourself would try to, you know, deal with it in a different way. So it's very personal, subjective process.
And also things shift in time. I mean, I'm thinking of the early translations of Camus, which in its first English form were incredibly syntactical and complex in the shape of the sentence. And then the last one I read of The Outsider, for instance, was so tight and so kind of Hemingway-like and based on a kind of Americanism which came from its translator, Sandra Smith. I want to reread Camus now. I wish she could translate all of it. I would love to read all of Camus again, both in that earlier form and that later form, because then we get the sense of the movement of Camus through English, through different versions of English culture, and or culture in English, rather. So this, you know, the interpretation question is in itself completely exciting, you know, really.
But also, in a way, if you had five or six translations of something, the original is somewhere in between those.
Yeah, exactly.
There is a theory that one way of understanding a poem is you read 20 translations of it, and none of them will quite be the poem. But somewhere in this mist will be the thing you started with.
Yeah.
We are out of time there. I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop there. I've written at the bottom of my page roundup ideas, which I'm not going to attempt to do because I don't have that kind of brain. But I think one thing that's become clear from this conversation is I think we all agree that we want more translation. We think this is a good thing. We want it to be good if possible, bad, whatever that means. We haven't resolved this one. But also I think that the something which Ali referred to in her provocation, which I think has come up, is this idea that somehow a conversation about translation is not separate from a conversation about literature. It's not separate about a conversation about language. That it does infiltrate all of the conversations about things that we sort of assume that we understand why they're important. So we want more of it. I think we want more sophisticated conversation around it, which I think is what we've got from you lovely people today. So please join me in thanking our three brilliant speakers, Charlie Gray, Maggie Kassel, and Ali Smith.
Thank you, Ali, and thank you, Margaret, and also thank you, Jalou, and thank you, Daniel. My name is Chris from Writers Centre Norwich. I just wanted to finish off this evening by, first of all, thanking our translators and authors by repeating, I suppose, what Ella said earlier. The national conversation is the starting point and not an ending point. We are heading off to in Cartagena with Binyavanga Wainana and Taya Selassie. We're heading back to Bath with Meg Rossoff, who's going to be asking what we are teaching our children about reading and writing. We're coming to the London Book Fair with Philip Gwynne-Jones, who's going to be asking who's really making money from books. And he's going to have the baton taken from him by Erica Wagner, who's asking who's picking up the casualties after the wars of the books have ended. And we're going to be having Carmilla Shamsi at Hay in Wales, asking who's voting for who in prize juries and does your gender have anything to do with it. It's been a real pleasure to welcome you here tonight, and also to Ali and our other guests. It was like having a very large, very fast intake of highly oxygenated air to breathe. And thank you for that, and thank you all for coming this evening. Thank you.